Hi, I'm Andrew. Welcome to the Review Two Dice Two Engineering podcast. I'm here today with Robert Hoagland, and we're going to be talking about the future of CDR, where we are and where we're going from here, and how far we could get. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
All right. So do you want to start us off by giving your many affiliations so people understand where you fit into the landscape? Because you're both unconventional and quite important in this field, I might argue.
Thanks. So I do a bunch of different things. Co-founded CDR FYI, so tracking all the transactions in durable carbon removal and being that kind of center point for the data. And we recently published this year in review for 2023. Then I also manage the Milky Way Climate Transformation Fund, which is a funder of carbon removal where companies like Klarna and Spotify put their money into this charitable fund. And we curate a portfolio of nascent carbon removal projects, but also in emission reductions in nature. And there we just had a call for proposals, getting hundreds of CDR applications that I'm deep down in assessing currently. And besides that, I also write papers and reports and blog posts, etc., for Carbon Gap, for example.
So just focusing on that kind of clearinghouse idea that you have, you're perhaps a little bit like Frontier or something like that. Is that correct?
It's it's quite similar to Frontier. It's not yacht carbon removal, and it's a bit smaller. We don't have $1 billion, but yes.
Okay, so you do stuff, you know, not only carbon removal, you're doing stuff that's focused on emissions reductions and nature-based solutions and stuff like that for people who want to buy that kind of stuff. Is that right?
It's a way for companies to take responsibility for their emissions. So Klarna, for example, uses an internal carbon tax, so taxing themselves voluntarily, and that generates a budget that they put into the fund, so it goes to carbon removal and then the other types of projects as well. We try to help reach global net zero as effective as possible, so focusing on the long-term impact, not just sort of what you get in the short term, but also on R&D, policy change, and all these nascent carbon removal solutions.
So where does your money come from? What out of those activities, which are quite varied, are, you know, revenue generating? I'd imagine that, you know, being a sort of carbon credit broker of or whatever it is that you exactly call what you do is a revenue generating activity. But I think a lot of people are interested by how people fund their work. And, you know, a lot of people in this field, they're not really working for money. Money is just how they work, right? So, you know, all revenue funding is, that's not, you know, compromised in some ways, is welcome. And so it's interesting to see how you built what is likely to be regarded as a very unconventional career in the field, right?
Yeah. Milky Wire is a company in Sweden that I do work with a lot, and like majority of my time managing this climate transformation fund. And there, the companies like Spotify, Klarna, ING Bank put their charitable donations into a foundation, and then some of that money is used for administration and project selection, etc. So that's where I get paid for the work I do on the fund. Then I do work for Carbon Gap and writing reports, and that's kind of more as a consultant on an hourly basis. And CDR.FYI has been a volunteer effort, but now we're turning that into a real company and trying to explore different revenue-generating efforts there as well to be able to sustain this as the market grows. It's going to take a lot of time. It's already taking a lot more effort and hours spent.
I think in terms of what you've done overall, I think CDR FYI is probably what you're best known for and the most impactful area of your work in terms of the broader community. Obviously, your direct customers have been more impacted by the services that you've offered in terms of doing this kind of market making, clearinghouse type role. But in terms of your influence in the field, I would suggest that the CDR FYI has been very influential. Basically, anybody I'm annoyed with because they get more traction than we do, then I kind of assume they're doing pretty well. And it is quite annoying to see how much traction you've got so quickly with the CDR FYI. So do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just me, right? Just to quickly clarify it. Yeah. We started out with this spreadsheet and that I set up tracking all the transactions, all the durable purchases of carbon removal. And then Kevin Neparkos out of the US, the software background, built a site around it and we started collaborating. And since then, now we brought on Alex Rink, who's a very experienced founder of many companies and many volunteers as well, such as Tang Shan and Quentin about a year, if I could say
last night. Are these people all full time or not?
No, it's been on a kind of volunteer basis so far.
Okay. So you're looking to get to the FYI funded. So is it going to be, you know, a public benefit project, or is it going to be a profit making company,
a public benefit corporation?
Okay, so it's basically designed to sort of handle money but not make money, as it were, right?
Yeah, that where the we can still be a profit making entity, but sort of with the purpose of furthering CDR, right? Instead of just
it's not designed to return cash to shareholders, but it can make money from its activities, right?
Yeah, basically that's what a PVC is. Yeah.
Okay, fine. So it's not going to end up like Bloomberg or anything like that. I mean, you know, such comparisons might seem silly at the moment, but CDR is going to be, hopefully, a massive industry if its founders those active in that industry. If their vision is fulfilled, I mean, there are obviously people who think CDR shouldn't be in it, a big industry, but the people who are working in it obviously expect it to be, and therefore it would stand to reason that, you know, a lot of people are going to get very rich off it. You know, we might have kind of John Paul Gettys and Rockefellers of CDR. It sounds a bit bizarre now as I'm looking at my rather untidy kitchen that should have been refurbished 20 years ago, that there's going to be some money in this industry. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that there is going to be a lot of money in this industry in due course. And people are going to want to understand how the business models fit together and, you know, how they can get set up their institutions and how they can get paid for what they do. So interesting that you've taken this public benefit corporation route. So if we can start logically in True Review 2 fashion at the end, I understand that you've got a new work that's come out fairly recently looking at the kind of terminal state of carbon removal. So do you want to give us the title of that and where people can find it? Because you're too lazy to publish anything properly, aren't you? So you put everything on the internet. So there's no journal as such, but where can people find your work?
So the CDR year in review is on cdr.fyi under the blog. So that sort of tackles what happened in 2023 and sort of where we're heading and if we're on track. But I also published on marginalcarbon.substack.com where I cannot do my article writing and blogging. So yeah.
Okay. So marginal carbon is where you're talking about the, you know, how far we can get in CDR, the sort of terminal state. What's the end game of CDR, right?
Well, it's kind of talking about the latest piece, carbon removal is not a finite resource. So responding to some recent publications from various writers that talk about it in the way that carbon removal will be in very short supply and must be carefully allocated. And I would argue that if you're deploying CDR now, you're not stealing away from that sort of finite pot. Instead, you're growing the cake, and the only way to get more CDR is to deploy it and to buy it. And I think the mindset where you see it as a kind of a finite cake that you're drawing from is wrong. It's applicable on some very limited things like land use, but not in general.
It's interesting that you kind of take this perspective. It's interesting that you've sort of stumbled across this perspective. I think this actually runs a lot deeper than just carbon removal. I kind of think that you've got sort of two camps, really. You've got the kind of, you know, the finite resource people that are characterized by a lot of the sort of deep green thinking and a lot of kind of old school socialists. And you've got, on the other hand, the sort of techno-optimist Elon Musk capitalist types who, you know, want to shoot for the stars. There seems to be a really fundamental division in society between two theories. One is that, you know, we have to focus on making sure that what we've got is allocated correctly. The other one is focused on kind of generating as much stuff as possible, where, you know, stuff might be digital or, you know, exploration of land beyond the solar system, beyond the earth, you know, all kinds of things to be put into that equation as stuff.
Yeah, it's like fixed mindset versus growth mindset.
Exactly, yeah. And so you're coming down on the sort of growth mindset side of things.
Yeah.
So if we look at the basic physics of carbon removal, I mean, you could imagine a future in which we have orbiting solar stations collecting the sun's energy and beaming it down to Earth to power, you know, calciners on Earth, or using fusion to generate calcining. And there doesn't seem to be any obvious limit to that. So why do people who think there's a limit think there's a limit?
Well, I think there's several reasons. One is that a lot of the discussion about carbon removal in the past have been on been land dependent, for example. So BECCS, for example, and being featured so much on growing energy crops, and I used to work for Oxfam, and they published papers on kind of like how much land that we'll be using, et cetera, and not really looking too much at more modern technologies for carbon removal. And for land, I mean, it is correct. Like if you offset your fossil emissions by planting forests, then that's a one-off. You use that resource basically, unless you do something else with the trees later on. Some
So if
people
we look
might.
at BECCS, for example, just to sort of put some kind of scale on it. So let's imagine the world continued using fossil fuels at broadly the current levels, which are, although flattening, they're around the maximum that we've got. I think there's some suggestion that fossil fuel use might have slightly fallen recently, but I don't think it's far off the peak. So if we were to sort of create a sort of BECCS economy, I've heard that BECCS might occupy the kind of land area of India, which is obviously quite a
Yeah.
lot of land, and annoyingly, the Indians are using it for things like India, selfishly, when we need it for BECCS. But let's assume that we could solve the problem and borrow India from them, and they could live in boats in the sea or whatever. But if we had a whole India to use, would that be enough, or would we need to, borrow a few other countries for BECCS?
Yeah, I think I've seen similar things. So it's probably something like that. But I think another reason why people think like this is that maybe they're conflating two different questions. So one question is, if we only have, say, 2 gigatons of carbon removal, how should we best allocate that? And for various political reasons, they might think that we won't have more than that because it's just going to be too difficult, etc. So they're trying to answer maybe question number two, looking at, well, if we only have that much, it should only be used for very limited sectors, etc. But that doesn't mean that using CDR today somehow depletes that future capacity. That's a completely different thing. Deploying as much CDR today as possible, basically, given our very nascent state, is what builds that future capacity. So the more we deploy now, the more we learn, the more we build infrastructure, and the more carbon removal we have for various purposes in the future as well. And if you say that it's free for all to use carbon removal now or whatever, you're not so strict on exactly who buys carbon removal, for example, then governments can also always decide later on at net zero 2050, saying that, okay, no one can use carbon removal for offsetting. It's just going to be for our historic emissions or whatever. Like you can always do that. But a key thing I really want to argue that you don't deplete future resources by, deploying carbon removal today.
Well,
You
to
build
me,
it.
that seems self-evident. I mean, you've got a situation like with a kind of Moore's law where you're growing your capacity to compute over the years by designing better computers. And, the idea that in the 1960s that people could have, real-time 3D rendering on phones they carry around in their pocket would have seemed pretty bizarre, I think, to people in the 1960s who could kind of conceive that sort of stuff on in theoretical applications and university level mainframes and things like that. But what I'm trying to probe here is you and I seem to sort of get that, but why do people who have a different view think how they do? Is it just that they are just so focused on this kind of old school socialism the scarcity mindset that they just can't imagine the world being any different from that in reality? Or are there some genuine limits to CDR capacity that make their arguments more than just superficially dismissible, basically?
Now, of course, there's finite limits, but I think it comes down to this conflation of two very different questions. So, like, if CDR is limited in the future, we need to decide on how to best to use it. But if you try to restrict the usage of CDR too much now, CDR will be limited in the future, right? So it's two different things. We can think about what's the best use of carbon removal later on, like when we see how much we have, in a way, at net zero. But saying that we should already today start limiting the use of carbon removal for only some very niche activities, or some people say that, Microsoft is not hard to abate, so they shouldn't be buying carbon removal or something like that. I think that's completely wrong. Then you're conflating that question about how to best use a finite resource in the future with what do we do today to optimally with funds, and how should we use our efforts to scale carbon removal. Those are two
Okay,
very different
well,
things.
I've got to try hard here to sort of pretend to be an old school commie, because It doesn't come naturally to me, as people who know me might realize. If I could try and get my head around the argument I think people are making and present it to you in a slightly different way, I think what people might say about carbon removal is that it's not necessarily that carbon removal is, in absolute terms, limited in supply. That's not really where the problem comes from. The problem comes from the fact that carbon removal is often done as an imperfect solution or as a fig leaf. So if you take Microsoft as an example, they are planning to reverse their emissions, but they're planning to reverse their emissions using a lot of nature-based solution and a little high-quality carbon removal. And even some high-quality removal isn't necessarily that high quality, like things like biochar, which have got, you know, benefits from a climate point of view. I think most people would agree. It's not quite the same as, you know, turning it back into coal and burying it for 300 million years under the ground, right? So
maybe we don't know, really. That's a separate question, but yeah.
Yeah, but let's assume that that argument is credible, because I don't think it's utterly foolish, put it that way, right? So I think it would be sensible to at least, you know, hear out these people's arguments. So taking Microsoft for an example, would it be better to sort of turn around and scold Microsoft a bit more and say, you know, don't go and fly to so many conferences and, you know, don't go and do things that, you know, they're using climate to some extent as a proxy for the environmental damage they're doing through their organization. But if you go to a conference, yes, that conference involves, you know, carbon for travel and heating and lighting and all of that. But there's also a whole bunch of waste, which isn't directly a climate impact, but it still has an environmental impact. So, you know, is it perhaps more sensible that we just consume a little less? You know, as Gandhi said, live simply so that others can simply live. Is that not really at the core of the argument, rather than just this kind of engineering-based how much carbon removal could we conceivably do? Are we perhaps almost parodying the arguments of our opponents rather than really addressing them?
No, the way you solve that is to have separate targets for carbon removal and emission reductions, and you have, you know, reasonable emission reductions targets that and don't overly rely on carbon removal and don't overly rely on it in the future. I wrote another paper for Carbon Gap together with Sylvain and Eli there, which is called How to Avoid Carbon Removal Delay in Emission Reductions, where we have 12 suggestions for that can be implemented for that. So it's not really, I think those are all relevant issues, but they can be solved. But the answer is not to see carbon removal as something that should be kept to a minimum today. You know, we should plan for it.
Is anyone really arguing that, or are you strawmanning? Yeah. Are they saying that carbon removal is limited, or are they saying that, you know, carbon removal is being talked about or bought or delayed or used as a kind of delaying tactic in practice, not necessarily. I understand you can have separate targets and all that, but, you know, I think that some people are arguing that that's not how it's being used. It's being used, oh, we'll buy 2,000 tons of carbon removal and we'll just ignore the fact that our organization is emitting 100 times more than that. We're doing our bit. We've kind of paid our indulgences and repented for climate sins. We don't have to do anything more.
Well, this recent paper by Grubert and Talati would talk about luxury removals. So I think at least how I interpret their argument is a bit that, you know, some removals today are luxury removals that should be avoided. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, luxury, it's an interesting idea, isn't it? Like, you know, you buy a Dior handbag, you can go and get a bag from Primark and it costs you probably a hundredth of the price and it still holds your lipstick perfectly well, right? There's nothing inherently better about most designer goods. You know, okay, they might be slightly more durable, but, you know, it's a marginal effect. Most of the time you're buying luxury goods because you just want to show off how much bling you've got, right?
Yeah, it's good for the climate though, because you displace other things you would have done with that money. So your cost, your carbon intensity.
That's arguable because, you know, Dior still would spend a lot of their money. You know, they have to run events and, you know, promotions and advertising. That's always got a climate impact. So I don't think you can just sort of say, hey, a $600 handbag is...
Their profit margins are insane, right? So maybe...
Yeah, their profit margins are insane, but other people are chasing them. So there are other people investing in the luxury industry and, you know, creating things like freebies and going to events and, you know, hosting luxury retreats for influencers. I don't think you can just sort of simply apply the argument that a kind of $600 handbag is somehow environmentally benign, where a $10 handbag isn't. I don't think it's as simplistic as that. But the idea that luxury removals are used as a sort of status signal They're called Veblen goods, basically. The economists call them Veblen goods. Mm-hmm. I've actually looked at doing a paper on this. It's one of the many papers that I was incredibly enthusiastic and then died somewhere during the production process. And looking at where the carbon removals were, in fact, Veblen goods, where people will pay, you know, more or buy more of the more expensive carbon removals. Now, that, you know, isn't objectively true at the moment. You know, there's a very large market that are for low quality carbon removals. But it seems that there's a sort of sub-market emerging, which might be considered to be a Veblen good type market, where people are basically trying to buy the most expensive or perceived best.
What I mostly reacted to was the description of CDR as a conventionally depletable resource. That was also in this Gruberton and Talati
paper. I've
seen that in other...
You're very well placed to comment on whether CDR is a Veblen good. I mean, do you see a sort of two-tier market emerging where, you know, where people are almost chasing the most expensive product, right? I mean, things like Climeworks, where they're mineralizing it and probably be hundreds of thousands of years before that carbon comes back. And, you know, people do seem to be quite willing to buy at those high prices. So do you think that there is a sort of snob good factor that where people are buying this super expensive stuff where a bag of biochar would be, you know, effectively just as good?
If it exists, maybe it does, but then it's a very, very small phenomenon, you know, affecting very few companies. So it's not a big thing. There's a lot more people buying Dior handbags, I would say.
What I'm saying is that, you know, of the carbon removal market, do you think that people buying from people like Climeworks are buying, you know, because they want to buy the most expensive, the perceived best thing in the market, right?
Yeah, I don't think that the price would be something that plays into that. It's more like Climeworks is the most well-known. They have the Orca plant operational already for quite some time. And then people might be willing to pay the price that they ask. But it's small volume still, right? So when you build your mega companies, it's a different thing.
A lot of these companies have pre-sold, and they pre-sold quite a long time in advance. So people are sort of selling 5 years in advance, aren't they?
Yes, but Climeworks' second facility, Mammoth, is... What is it, 36,000 tons per year or something? So it's also not the megaton scale.
Yeah, it's not enormous. But the 1.5 one, I've just seen the 1.5 one getting built, and that's absolutely massive, isn't it?
But that might not be as expensive.
Okay. But, I mean, they don't sell to the public, do they, 1.5? They sell to oil companies to recover oil from the Permian Basin. Is that right?
And they might use some CO2 captured in some of their plants for enhanced oil recovery, but I think... If I remember correctly, they wouldn't mix that. So I think the facility that sells to companies is not for enhanced oil recovery, but I can't swear. But yeah, their customers is a bunch of different companies, Amazon, airlines, the American football team, etc.
And do you know what price point they're selling at? I mean, you probably, if anybody, would know roughly where the market is. So what, you know, how?
Yeah, there's no public pricing there.
Can you not bribe people and use honey traps and all kinds of nefarious methods to get prices in the market? I mean, it is like you're like the kind of guy, the go-to guys, right? So it wouldn't be beyond you to go and do a bit of espionage.
We might be able to make an estimate, and it's definitely going to be lower than the Climeworks prices for sure. And something we are developing on CRFYI is our anonymous prices, so you can report your sales even if you don't want to report your name or your who's buying it, and then that could feed into the sector prices or like the method prices. So you keep your anonymity, but we can see what we have more granular data on what things are costing.
Yeah, I'm talking about anonymity. I did a so-called anonymous interview yesterday for someone's research project, and I was kind of talking to them and listening to what I was saying. It was like, anybody reading this who has the vaguest knowledge of me as an individual is going to know it's me. This veil of anonymity is not going to work for very long, but at least it gives me a degree of plausible deniability. I try not to opine about things in public, and when I'm in some kind of like closed door interview, I can let rip and say what I really think. So your view is that, if I could sort of paraphrase what you're saying, you're taking a kind of Moore's law view of this, that, you know, the progress in the market is driven by the existence of the market. If we weren't building computers, we wouldn't get better at making computers. Therefore, we need to focus on, you know, building computers as fast as possible to make sure that future computers are as good as they could be. That's your sort of the central kind of plank of your argument. Is that right?
Yeah, basically, yes.
Okay, so looking to the future then, how what does the, if the end is kind of infinite to infinity and beyond, then what does the path look like? What do you project are the growth in CDR will look like in terms of, you know, sectors and prices and markets and volumes?
So we have looked at that, and at part of this CDR FYI year review, there was this rubric if we are on track or not, and are we trending on track? And it's kind of hard to say because you can reach the end target in many different ways, and there's also not perfect agreement on what the end target is. What is a suitable level at 2050? But if we say it's at least 10% of today's emissions, like, you know, the SBTI implies, and did you have to keep...
Well, if I just draw you on that, I mean, like, if you say it's at least 10% of today's emissions, I mean, like, if you view that climate change is already a problem, then removing last year's emissions is important. And then to remove last year's emissions, you probably want to remove, you know, last year and all future emissions.
Yeah, of course. Now I'm talking about...
Right?
So here I'm just talking about to reach net zero. I think it's good to keep these things separate so people know what one is talking about when you say when we talk about the need for CDR, because one, there's a clear entity that might pay for it, and the other, there's not. So okay, if we talk about the need for carbon removal to reach net zero, like, the in theory it's zero because almost all emissions are theoretically abatable. So you could stop doing an activity, or you could do it some with very expensive ways. You could create electric fuels, and you can create synthetic plastics, and you can create steel that are zero emissions, et cetera, et cetera. But for some...
You say very expensively, but I mean, are these things really going to be very expensive in due course? I mean, we're like, solar panels were very, very expensive, and almost like a kind of flight. They were like the fancy carbon removal of, you know, 20 years ago.
Putting
expensive solar panels to show off, right?
These things also fall in price. So carbon removal for net zero, a permanent carbon removal for net zero, is you should use it wherever it's optimal, basically. And we're working on some things and carbon gap as well on kind of these questions on hard to abate and what's optimal. But price is one thing. It's not the only thing to look at. But for some things, if you look at electric fuels, for example, where you use captured CO2 to turn that into fuel, you basically use DAC in both cases, even if you use CDR and business as usual, or if you use electric fuels to displace the fossil fuel. It's just when you make electric fuels, you also take in a lot of hydrogen, which is more resource intensive than step one where you do the DAC. So in that case, business as usual with permanent carbon removal might be much cheaper and less resource intensive than using electric fuels. So that's one case where permanent CDR might be preferable for various
reasons. I just want to reiterate that to make sure that people have got it. So what you're saying is that if you're digging out fossil fuels and then abating those fossil fuels using a kind of physically displaced carbon removal. So it's like carbon capture and storage, because you're abating today's emissions, but you're not abating it by putting a cap on the chimney and catching the emissions. You're letting those emissions go to air, and then you're using direct air capture. So the carbon goes out of the ground and then it comes back into the ground. But the energy comes out of the ground and stays out, right? Whereas the alternative is that you make electric fuels, where your energy is all from renewables, and then you're using the electric fuels just as a carrier molecule to carry the energy around. That's just to sort of draw that critical distinction, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And you would need then permanent carbon removal for whatever fossil emissions you have ongoing at net zero. That's the like-for-like principle. So the need for the optimal use for permanent carbon removal might be a few gigatons. It might also be that you have emissions in your scope 3 that's very tricky to do something about, even though they're theoretically abatable. But since you want to sort of trade on a global market, et cetera, you might want to offset that with permanent carbon removal.
So scope 3 emissions are the emissions that your customers generate from the products that you sell, right?
Suppliers as well. Yeah, your suppliers and your customers, but yeah.
Okay. So if you're Shell, for example, then your scope 3 emissions would be the emissions that come from people buying your fuel and then burning your fuel, right?
Yes, yes. Or if you're H&M, it's emissions from the factories where you buy from.
Okay, that's fine. Right. So you're kind of describing two different models there. One where DAC is used to remove emissions that where the energy comes from the ground, digging up fossil fuels, which is much more like a kind of business as usual type idea. And then you've got a more kind of radical revisioning of the economy where we might have the same energy carriers as we've got at the moment. You know, we're still using stuff that looks like diesel and stuff that looks like natural gas to heat our homes, but the energy is coming from solar, but it's being converted into other sources of fuel. So at the moment in Britain, for example, you've got a big push to try and get people onto heat pumps, which is all very well, but there are some big technical problems, as I've discovered from trying to put a heat pump in my own house. And it might be easier in theory to just say, oh, stuff it, we'll just, you know, put hydrogen into the natural gas grid, change the boilers a little bit, but not very much. Yeah. And so people can use their existing boilers or boilers that are quite similar to the ones that exist and not change much, right?
It's kind of a niche case, I think, of aviation, maybe some shipping, some other places. But for direct electricity is probably going to be best for a lot of different use cases.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, I think it's worth exploring this because, although this stuff isn't directly CDR, it makes a big difference. So, you know, now I went to a trade show this week. I work in construction. My day job is in the built environment sector. It's not working in this field. And Heidelberg Cement have now got a zero carbon kiln that they're building in Norway, and they're building another one in Germany. I think eventually they're going to build one in the UK as well. And the idea of this is to have a completely net zero cement. In fact, it's probably net negative. I think they're rather underclaiming it because the claiming is net zero, but actually it's net negative because when the cement is poured, it will carbonate over time, over the sort of 100 years that a building is standing, and then will eventually remove carbon from the atmosphere. And they're not counting that, as far as I recall, in their figures, which is interesting that they've omitted to do that, because I think that would, you know, probably be quite profitable for them if they were to work out how much of that carbon that's captured would then be, you know, newly recaptured from the air to give you net negative cement. And also you've got similar in steel. I think isn't there a project called HyNet or something in Sweden that is about producing net negative or net zero steel?
Hybrid, yeah. It's both hybrid and then H2 green steel now as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So both of those are taking, you know, traditionally very carbon intensive industries and then converting them to be kind of net zero type approaches. So it doesn't seem to me beyond the wit of man that will just sort of steadily propagate through the economy. But you're quite right to draw attention to the fact that there are some sectors that we really struggle to deal with at all. And these include some pretty fast growing sectors. So as you sensibly pointed out, aviation is one of them. So could you, when you were looking at the ultimate scope of carbon removal, like how much we will eventually need to do, where do you see the genuinely hard to abate sectors? Because I think 10 years ago, people might have said steel and cement, but now it looks increasingly likely that when you've got these large, you know, sensible multinationals building pretty large scale plants, albeit, you know, quite small for them maybe, but, you know, they're still large commercial scale plants, that maybe this problem isn't so insoluble as it might have looked 10 years ago. So what are the truly insoluble sectors?
Yeah, no, I think the correct analysis is to look at where permanent carbon removal is the optimal option rather than when there is the only option, because it's not the only option for anything, basically.
What about a transatlantic flight? How would you do a trans-Pacific flight?
Electric fuels.
Oh, yeah, okay, I suppose so, yeah.
But then, like, this is two different perspectives a little bit. Like, what sectors are CDR optimal for? But then we'll use a little bit more CDR than what's optimal, because companies want to reach their net zero target earlier than the whole world is decarbonized. So no one thinks that all steel plants in the whole world will be, you know, completely zero emissions by 2050. And you might have some of that steel somewhere in supply chain. You might have some diesel trucks somewhere in your supply chain, and you're not going to get completely rid of that. So you'd use CDR for a few decades to reach your net zero target. But as those decarbonize, the role for permanent carbon removal and net zero might get smaller and smaller. It might be some niche cases, but it's still going to be gigatons, I think, where it just will be the most optimal level, especially if the cost drops below $100 per ton or something like that. Then
okay, so let me just repeat that back to you and explain what I think you've explained to me, because this is a central point there. So what you're saying is that even in a world which is technologically gearing up for net zero, what you're suggesting is there are practical limits to the speed of transition, and there are legacy dirty industries. So while you might have green steel suppliers in the supply chain, it might be easier and cheaper to build carbon removal to deal with the consequences of having those legacy emissions in the supply chain than it will be to just rip down every steel plant and, you know, rebuild it. Because you think the carbon removal will get down to the level of, you know, of order $100 a ton rather than of order $1,000 a ton, which is where it is at the moment, right? And therefore, the urgency to decarbonize, you know, to roll out the latest technology into these legacy kind of long capital lifetime things like cement plants, where you know, a cement plant can keep going for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, right? You don't necessarily need to close down all of these cement plants. You can, you know, still use the old ones, provided you're using DAC to kind of deal with their emissions.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct. And it's also a question of control. So if your supply chain is long and wide, even though, you know, might be theoretically cheaper to do the low emission, no emission thing, you don't have control. You can't just buy from zero emission suppliers, for example. So you have some carbon removal just because that's practically your option.
It becomes like an MRV problem, right? So you've got to actually find a way to monitor and manage your supply chain. And there might be some monitoring and managing that can't be done in practical terms. And therefore, you would use an approach which is based on carbon removal to sort of catch the, what you might call, ghost emissions that you can't be sure whether they do or don't exist. Mm. But you would nevertheless want to keep an eye on them. And so you'd kind of overbuy a little bit. Is that what you're saying? Or am I misunderstanding your point?
Yeah, to some extent. But I think also if you're a global company, and it's going to be hard to just buy from zero emission suppliers if your net zero target is 2040 or 2050 or something, because there's going to be so big parts of the world that are still not at net zero, that if you want to reach your targets, you just have to do some extra CDR for your scope free emissions to cover that. But it's transitional, maybe for a few decades until the whole world has reached net zero, and then permanent carbon will only be for the sector where it's truly optimal. And how much that is, it's hard to say, but, you know, aviation is one thing, plastics and chemicals could be as well, but those things would need to be carefully looked at.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned cement. I mean, I'd just like to challenge that, if I may.
Because, did I say cement?
Well, you said cement earlier, not in the list that you just gave me, but you said cement earlier. We're talking about cement kilns being something you might want to offset with CDR. But I think that's quite an interesting example, because if you look at a company like Airlink, what they're operating is basically something which is pretty closely akin to a cement kiln. It's just their final product isn't cement, right?
No, I think the CCS is probably the option for cement rather than CDR.
Well, I agree. And the reason I was highlighting that is because, you know, you'd end up, if you were trying to offset some emissions from a cement kiln using CDR, then you'd basically be operating another cement kiln to offset output from a cement kiln.
If I said cement, then it was a slip of tongue. I agree.
Okay, fine. Right. Well, I mean, maybe just something that I kind of misinterpreted from what you were saying rather than your mistake. But anyway. So to summarize, what you think is going to happen is that we're going to have supply chains which are, with some legacy technologies, quite complex, sometimes hard to track what's going on, and we'll need CDR to deal with those, not because we lack new technologies to address the emissions that are legacy, but because there's a lag in the development and dispersal of these technologies throughout the global supply chains. And so CDR will be there required to sort of pick up the gap. But crucially in this, you're not looking at the historic emissions, things that have already happened.
You know? I'll come to that. Yeah. So, and just a final word on this, that yes, for a lot of emissions, it will be transitional. But for some sectors, CDR might be the optimal thing in perpetuity. So that's also a possibility for aviation.
So when you say, so you've got long distance flights that you might want to use CDR as opposed to making electric fuels for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you say perpetuity, is there not at least a possibility that it will just become, you know, so expensive to dig up oil relative to something we do all the time, like CDR, that actually it's just cheaper to go and do the carbon removal that we need from e-fuels rather than continuing to dig up fossil fuels?
Yeah, it could come to that, but I think there's lots of cheap fossil fuels and fossil fuels, and if aviation is one of the last use cases, then that cheap resources might last for a long time. But of course, that would be something that you have to re-evaluate going forward, for sure. But then about historic emissions and also offsetting nitrous oxide or methane, for example, if you want to do that, going under like for like removal kind of umbrella. But for historic emissions, I think it would be hard to claim that you have to use permanent carbon removal to offset your historic emissions, because like the needs are just so great. And
if, let me just grab you on something you just said there, because it's hugely significant. So you were saying about using CDR to offset methane. Okay. Now, that's a radical proposal, and I've actually not heard people talk about that previously. So just to clarify what I think you meant by that, you're suggesting that we remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to offset the fact that we're adding methane to the atmosphere. Okay. Now, that is notable because they are very much not geophysically equivalent actions. Yeah. They are very different, because methane has a lifetime in the atmosphere of decades. Carbon dioxide has a lifetime of millennia. So talk to me about how that might work. I mean, like in a situation where we only emit methane and we haven't had this legacy carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we could end up with severe overcooling once methane emission stops. Now, that's a kind of abstract risk, but if we could just talk about that, because that genuinely isn't something we've ever had anybody talk about in the podcast.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I'm happy to talk about that as well. I wrote another post in September about this.
And what's the title of that?
How much carbon we will need to remove.
I think we actually, wasn't that something that we came back, that we had you on to discuss? That might have been the topic, because I know you came on about 9 months or a year ago, didn't you? And I think that's one of the things that you spoke about.
Did I talk about that?
I can't recall.
I think this is more recent than our last podcast. But even so, let's revisit it. And so permanent carbon removal would lead to global cooling if you offset methane continuously. Yes, all else equal. But you could use temporary...
Well, hold on. It wouldn't lead to global cooling if you offset methane. It would only
if you use a GBP 100 or something. I don't know.
Like, yeah, basically, if you continue to offset methane, in that basically, let's break this down, because I want to get this right. If you are planning for a world where you have methane emissions, and that is, there's a constant level of methane emissions, you'd end up with a constant forcing from methane. Whereas with carbon dioxide, if you have a constant level of emissions in non-geological timescales, your carbon dioxide concentration would rise continuously. And so you're always getting hotter and hotter and hotter. If you're continually emitting methane, you're not getting hotter and hotter and hotter. You're just getting hot and staying hot, right? So you only have to remove the carbon once to compensate for the methane you're releasing, because that carbon is functionally, on human timescales, permanent, whereas the methane is temporary. Yeah?
Yeah, correct. So if you would be doing... You could use temporary carbon removal where you for example, have bulk biomass stored in soils that breaks down after a couple of decades, or you do a forest harvesting that you wait a couple of extra decades and increase the forest stocks for a while, but it's just very temporary. Those things could, for example, be used to offset methane if you time match it. So you use a multiplying, like maybe you use global warming potential 20 then, and you have carbon stored for 20 years and you offset methane, then it will be the same thing. Then it's time matched.
Yeah. Okay.
And you for nitrous oxide, which have a lifetime of 100 years, then maybe you say forestation. Maybe we say that, given the risk of reversal, we think 100 years is reasonable, something like that. And you could use forestation to offset nitrous oxide emissions. We think we will have 2 gigatons of nitrous oxide emissions by net zero. It's going to be very hard to get rid of them. But maybe you don't need permanent carbon removal for those things. It's just for fossil fuels that where you need, under the like-for-like principle, you would need carbon removal. But yeah, okay. There would be a massive need. It would be very hard to offset all methane. Like, that would be ridiculous amounts of temporary carbon removal, like, you know, tens of gigatons.
Let me just sort of step through. So if you're planning on having a society which continue to emit methane, which I don't think is that unreasonable, because people like eating burgers. And if you assume
the natural
people,
system has methane as well, so even if
the natural system does have methane, but we do produce a lot of methane from agriculture, and it is pretty difficult. Unless we're going to go and breed stuff that eats like a pig but tastes like a cow, then people are going to have to live in a world with more methane than we might want. And so it doesn't seem completely unreasonable that we might do like a one-off carbon removal to deal with the fact that we're going to have a high methane load. I think radiative forcing today is about one third methane, two thirds carbon dioxide, crudely. Is that right? Roughly?
Is it one third or is it 25% or something? Yeah, but something like that could
It,
be
yeah, it's
around.
around in that range. So in theory, what we could do is have, we could remove somewhere around a third to a half of the carbon dioxide we've ever emitted so that we can continue to eat burgers and have this
Yeah,
high methane
exactly.
emission.
But
I mean, it seems...
there are several papers that explore this as well, the sort of pulse removal to permanently offset an ongoing methane emission. And but that the level of carbon removal you have to do, as you now describe,
would be insane. Yeah. Like when you say it like that, it does sound kind of crazy, doesn't it? Like you're removing potentially up to half the carbon dioxide you've ever emitted just to deal with the methane emissions. A lot
in carbon budgets, like the global carbon budget for 1.5. There's an assumption on methane, but it's not part of the carbon budget. The carbon budget is just carbon. And so the assumption is that methane drops by half until 2050. So if it doesn't, then we have no carbon budget, basically, like today. And so if we stop using fossil fuels, methane goes down because it's like at least half of methane emissions come from fossil fuel extraction.
Fugitive emissions and stuff. Yeah. I just wrote a review paper on methane, so I should know my methane numbers loads better than I do, but I don't. In fact, so one of my layman friends just sort of asked me how much of methane is anthropogenic, and I just genuinely didn't know. I had to go and look at it, despite the fact that I just published a paper that encompassed that and many, many, many other statistics. I just genuinely didn't know my basic numbers. It's amazing how much there is to know in climate and how little of it my brain can hold at any one time. Mm-hmm. So basically what you're saying is that, I mean, okay, if we stop having fugitive emissions from oil and gas, that's going to make a big difference. But nevertheless, the fundamental comparison that I was making earlier is still kind of holds in that if we were to try and do a one-off removal of carbon dioxide to deal with the fact that we all like to eat burgers occasionally, that's going to be an absolutely massive amount of CO2 we're going to have to remove just to offset this very temporary methane load, right? So that's kind of impractical. What are the papers that have discussed that, if you happen to kind of know them off the top of your head? Because it would be interesting to, you know, to have that, those paper titles. I'm sure people would, at least some people listening to
I don't remember the exact title, so we'll have to put that in the show notes.
Okay, yeah. Well, I've said on a number of occasions on the podcast, we do have show notes, as you call them, the little podcast episode description. We try and make sure that all of the significant papers that are mentioned, not only the one that's reviewed, but all of the kind of citations that are critical to understanding the paper will be in the blurb for the podcast, which enables the keener listener to read around the subject. If you want to follow up and cite those papers in your work or just understand better what they say, then it's all there for you.
That covers the methane and the nitrous oxide and the part of net zero that's not carbon. But then on the historical emissions, I think, I mean, it's striking how big that is as well. Like every 0.1 degree that we want to decrease is about 222 gigatons of carbon removal. So it's going from, we're heading towards at least 1.8 degrees. I mean, with current net zero targets or something like that, we're probably might be even more. And going back then to 1.5 would be 666 gigatons. So that would be a huge need for CDR as well. And when people talk about 10 gigatons of carbon removal needed by 2050, they include this as well, right? But that's not all permanent carbon removal. That could be forestation and other things, which is also limited, of course. But it would be a massive thing. But here it's very unclear who would pay for it. Reaching net zero, we have companies and countries that are sort of responsible for doing it. Historic emissions are much trickier to get around to who would actually make sure that happens.
Okay, well, if we don't have geophysical limits to carbon removal, you're implying there a sort of certain degree of skepticism about the scale of carbon removal that might be needed. So, you know, geophysically, we can kind of remove all the carbon that we might need to remove.
But who pays for it?
Well, exactly. So, and this has always been my kind of problem with the sort of whole carbon removal ideology, really, is that to me, it just seems, you know, completely barking. Like, to kind of simplify this, the central problem is you can imagine economic sectors moving forward, where there's such value, for example, to flying executives across the planet to important business meetings, that it's well worth doing that kind of thing in the long run, even if we have to remove the carbon at, say, $1,000 a ton, right? There are some people whose flights are so important, they'd be quite happy to pay $1,000 a ton to be able to make that flight, right?
Yeah.
And so that isn't that hard to imagine economically that we might choose to do that as a society, at least in part. But, you know, when it comes to doing something like, for example, heating a very poorly insulated home, it doesn't make any sense to spend $1,000 a ton to remove that, because you can just put some insulation on the home, or turn the heating down, or put a jumper on. The problem is that we've got this sort of history of having emitted this vast amount of carbon on these extremely marginal economic activities that, you know, where there's almost no benefit, but yet we've done it anyway because carbon has been so cheap to emit. And we've got this like historical pollution of the atmosphere that's come about as a result of having spent, you know, a century or two doing exactly that. So if we kind of forget the geophysical limits, because as I said, we can have, you know, fusion reactors and beam power down from space to power calciners and spread calcium oxide over the deserts and wait for carbonate over decades, you know, all of that's possible in some kind of future sci-fi world. And, you know, that might sound absurd, but, you know, we kind of throw away computing potential today in a very similar way. We use computing completely profligately because it is so absurdly, you know, indetectably cheap. Like, we compute is, you know, too cheap to meter in the vast majority of cases now. It doesn't cost me appreciably any more to run my smartphone and run compute on my smartphone than it does to, you know, just have it sitting there. So, you know, I don't care about how much how many clock cycles I'm using to, you know, display a web page or whatever. So, you know, we could have a society where, you know, we're so rich in the future that we can do all this carbon removal. But, you know, that's not really the society we're talking about. What we're talking about is in the next few decades when carbon removal is probably still an appreciable cost. So where do the true limits to carbon removal come from? You know, if we're looking at a sort of a feasible economic environment in the next few decades, what you've implied from the conversation we were just having a moment ago is that there are, you know, really fundamental limits to carbon removal, not necessarily fundamental in terms of a number that cannot be breached, but they're fundamental in terms of the idea that we could just keep going to infinity and beyond is completely bonkers. So what can we do and what can't we do in coming decades? What is the limit of a realistic growth rate that we could have that would, you know, see as a sort of maximal level of carbon removal? What is that maximal level that you can imagine? I mean, I know it's going to be fuzzy, but, you know, you're going to be able to get it to an order of magnitude or so, right?
So, I mean, the final limit to carbon removal, I think in practice, will be the money you want to spend on it. And it's not going to be the geophysical limits or the ecosystem limits. It's going to the amount of money runs out before you run out of other things. But looking at kind of more, just circling back to the thing that we looked at, and if we're trending on track in the year review for CDR-FYI, there's many growth trajectories. And from something you could look at, this is new paper Greg Nemeth and Oliver Geddon and others wrote about in Joule, about looking at, this is the formative phase of CDR, and they looked at other technologies and how fast they've grown. And the way I interpret their graph is that carbon removal, durable carbon removal, we need cumulatively at least 3 gigatons before 2040 for it to be at the kind of 4 or 5 gigaton level in the 2050s. And if you don't have that kind of growth to reach 3 gigatons cumulatively by 2040, you would be struggling very hard and would need to grow much faster than other.
Let's write that down. So what, at the moment we're emitting of order 40 gigatons carbon dioxide at the moment, right? So by using 4 gigatons, we'd basically be saying in the sort of 2040s, 2050s, we'd be saying like, we've decarbonized 90% of the economy, and we therefore need 10% of the current emissions of carbon dioxide to be dealt with by CDR to get to a point where we've got net zero. That's roughly what you're suggesting as a kind of future trajectory, right? Okay, so if that 4,000, so it's 4,000 megatons or 4 gigatons.
Million tons, or billion tons.
So a ton of carbon dioxide is going to cost, in what price level would you assume it would be in the sort of 2040s, 2050s? I assume we're not talking about $1,000 a ton anymore. Are we talking about $100 a ton or what?
I think inflation adjusted to 2022 dollars or something like that, we're talking about 100 to 150 maybe.
Okay. So if you're trying to reduce that, See, if it's 100, let's call it $100 a ton, just for argument's sake. I mean, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but it's going to be approximately the right order of magnitude, right? So in 2040, 2050, you'd be spending about $400 billion per year, right?
Yeah.
To do 10% of the global carbon budget that we have today in CDR. So to kind of think about what $400 billion is, to build a decent sized shopping mall costs about $1 billion, right? Or a major passenger terminus station will cost about $1 billion. Yeah. So it's not inconceivable, like 400, there's about 170 odd countries in the world. So that's equivalent of every year, two shopping centers in every country in the world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be roughly what a level of economic activity. And to me, that sounds kind of practical. I'm not saying it would be like a good thing, something we'd want to do, but you know, it sounds like humanity could do it. It's comparable to probably what we spend on, you know, I don't know, cards and gifts or something like that, right? You know, globally. Mm-hmm. So not something that the world couldn't manage as a piece of economic activity, right?
Yeah, it would be 0.4% of today's GDP or something like that. But future GDP might be way higher as well. So
potentially.
But you also, it's not like an extra cost either. Like the alternative is you would do it because it's the cheaper thing to do. Remember?
Yeah. I mean, right? Like so, the loss and damage alone would be more expensive, right?
So yeah, or the alternative to reduce emissions in some other way.
Yeah. Okay. But the reason I'm following this logic is to, I'm trying to work out what the ultimate top cost is. So we don't have to stop there, do we? I mean, we could remove some legacy emissions. We could do that, for example, through general taxation, right? So mm-hmm. let's try and work out. I mean, you might have a figure in your head of what a reasonable limit is, or we might have to work this out from scratch. But let's assume that, so 0.4% of GDP is pretty minor. You know, I think if my tax level went up to the point I was spending 0.4% of my income, I'm not saying I wouldn't notice it necessarily, but I don't think my lifestyle would change to the point where, you know, the sky would fall in. I wouldn't have to sell my house and go and live in a van or anything like that, right? I think we could probably, most of us could find a way of economizing to the point that we save 0.4% of our income just by, you know, not wasting money, right? There's probably enough slack in the system to do that, right? It's quite a reasonable amount. And I think that what you're highlighting there is that because we can abate a lot of our emissions by technology shift, we don't have to worry too much about the cost of carbon removal. It becomes quite pragmatic. But let's imagine that we wanted to sort of really sort of push the boat out. What would be the kind of max? I mean, like when you move, for example, to a wartime economy, Russia is spending, I think, sort of tens of percent of its economy is now invested in killing Ukrainians. We perhaps couldn't sustain that long term, but you know, what would be a reasonable level that we, you know, could we do, say, 5% of global GDP into carbon removal?
That's where kind of the social cost of carbon and something like that comes in, I think. Like, what are the damages that's being done by having 1.8 degrees? Like, and what would the world in 2050 or 60 or 70 value getting that down through carbon removal? And you also have other alternatives, like with the name of this show, for example. So it's, yeah, those kind of considerations that would need to go into what people will do. And I'm kind of doubtful that people would decide to remove hundreds of gigatons of carbon removal and pay for that because if they think it's worth it. There's also adaptation as well as another option.
Well, yeah, look, what I'm trying to do here is just sort of work out what might be a feasible maximum. Now, I think that you could say that people are basically not really going to notice 0.4% of their income. You know, they might, that would be something which would be sufficiently minor that I think most people, they wouldn't even, you know, if the government decided that we're going to spend, you know, 0.4% of GDP on carbon removal, you'd only notice it because of the media controversy. You wouldn't really feel it in your pocketbook, right? So that would be something that is superficially quite manageable, right? Whereas if we were to spend 5% of GDP, I would say that's around 10 times what you were suggesting. To me, would imply that you are, you know, getting towards what might be considered to be a fairly reasonable limit on the amount of money that you could sustain in the longer term. Do you see what I mean? So, I'm asking is how far would we get for that 5%? What would 5% of GDP get? So if we'd be removing 10% of our emissions for 0.4% of GDP, we could potentially remove our entire annual emissions for 5% of GDP, the entire current emissions. So every year we'd be going back a year in terms of sort of turning back the clock, right? That would be possible, although not.
Of course, yeah. So, and that's also where the kind of 10 gigaton level comes from, because people, it's from models assuming that you go back to 1.5 before 2100. So then you have a time limit. Otherwise, you can do that over many, many centuries if you wanted to. And then that kind of 10 gigaton level is probably what's needed. But a lot of that can be in terms of forestation, for example, and whatever is most cost effective to do it. But yeah, as I said, I'm kind of doubtful what people will spend their money on. If you have the option to spend like hundreds, if even trillions of dollars on carbon removal or on climate adaptation to handle the heat that you're doing right, experiencing right now, that question might be, the answer might not be super straightforward, for example.
Well, I'm not saying it's straightforward. What I'm trying to do is just sort of get to a point where we can have some idea of how the future might look. So let's just roll with the example I've given you. So I've suggested that, well, you said that 0.4% of current GDP would enable us to remove 10% of our emissions each year, which would basically get us to net zero because we'd be dealing with legacy emissions. Now, I think 5% of GDP would be the sort of level where you could probably get to without, you know, massive social unrest. You know, it's expensive, but, you know, it's probably not incomparable with what we spent on something like education. You know, it's a major expenditure for the state, but it's not something that stops society working. Once you get to sort of 30, 40, 50% of GDP, I mean, you can get to the point where you can only sustain that very briefly. And, you know, when you have a societal level risk, like a war, right? So the Ukrainians are probably spending 30, 40% of the GDP on having a war, but, you know, they can't sustain that for 50 years. That's just not going to happen, right? But 5%, you know, we probably could sustain that in the long term. And that would be equivalent to winding back climate change by one current year of emissions every year. So over a century, we get back by, you know, a century. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that because a century ago, we weren't emitting nearly as much. But, you know, we'd probably have to keep going for around somewhere between 30 and 100 years at that pace to sort of get back to pre-industrial levels of carbon. So that is challenging, but it's not sort of like economically impossible, is it? We could, in theory, use carbon removal to completely undo climate change, but it would be around a level of about 5% of GDP, current GDP. And obviously, you know, as you say, we might all be enormously richer in future because we have like a robot supply chain. And if we want a factory, all we have to do is go and get a robot to build it for us. And we'd have to go and, you know, they don't have the limit of human labor, right? So, I mean, I've always assumed, perhaps like you've argued there, that it's kind of fundamentally impossible to do carbon removal in the future. But, you know, those figures perhaps imply that I'm being a bit pessimistic, or I have been a bit pessimistic up till now. It doesn't seem to be completely infeasible that we might spend 5% of global GDP, current global GDP, in an environment where we might all be twice as rich as now, which would mean 2.5% of global GDP. And we might continue to do that for, say, 50, 60 years, right? It doesn't sound absolute madness, does it?
No, it's possible for sure. It's within the realms of possibility. And something, if the world would have started using geoengineering, there would be probably a pretty strong push to actually remove the carbon so you don't get termination shock on and things like that. So that could increase the push for it as well.
Okay. So if you were to sort of like form a personal judgment call, where would you say this would get to? I mean, do you think we'll end up in a situation where we will be removing all of our legacy emissions artificially? Or do you think that that's just fanciful and there's no possibility that people are going to do that kind of thing? Or what's your view?
I focus most on net zero and the need for that now, because that sort of comes first and then you can go net negative. And it's going to be, a big challenge to reach net zero. And in other areas, the world is going to change maybe more in the coming decades than it's done in centuries before that. And I'm thinking of AI mainly. So it's very hard to talk about the future. But yeah, so I look at what are the needs for net zero and are we on the track to reach them? And if you do get to the kind of 4 gigaton level that might be needed to reach net zero, then you can scale up quickly from there into higher levels and start addressing historic emissions. But if you, if someone does that or not, that's is guesswork at best.
Well, I know you kind of, you're saying it's guesswork, but I'm just trying to pull you off the fence.
I wouldn't bet my money on people doing it. No, I think they would spend it on adaptation, climate adaptation instead. Yeah.
Well, that's really significant. So basically, what you're suggesting is somebody who's perhaps as close to the CDR industry as anybody, is that your personal view is that legacy emissions are permanent. We will never get rid of them.
At least not in the kind of levels that are needed. Net negative might happen at some point, but it, I don't think it would be as fast as, you know, bring it down to 1.5 again by 2100, for example. Unless there's some huge breakthrough, which, I mean, there are some pretty exciting ideas out there that very novel, you know, that might turn car removal into a dirt cheap thing. And then, yeah, it will probably happen.
Yeah, I mean, like, if we have, you know, extremely inexpensive fusion, for example, would be a way that we could expect that to happen, right? Now, whether or not we'll ever get extremely inexpensive fusion a la Back to the Future, then that's highly questionable. I mean, people have been trying to make fusion reactors for many decades now, and they've never, you know, none of them are commercial or even close to being commercial. I think there's a site in the UK that people are thinking of putting a commercial fusion reactor in, but that's not the same as having a commercial fusion reactor to put it on, right?
There's things like cold plasma could break CO2 into carbon monoxide and oxygen, like, where, you know, that's some wild ideas out there that might be very cheap. So
tell us about that. I mean, I don't know much about it. I
don't have that background enough to explain it, but it's way too complex for me to explain, but that's a pathway that some people
you tease us, Robert, with your tales of sci-fi carbon removal that you are unable to explain.
It's something that's going to happen. I'm just saying there are wild ideas out there that potentially, you know, you never know if something comes up that could be very, very cheap, and then it's a very different conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, for my money, I think that, you know, the basic chemistry of carbon removal, I don't think we need to necessarily change that much. I think what will potentially make a difference is if we have a step change in energy costs. It's at least conceivable that we could have an energy future in which, you know, you suddenly dramatically scale down energy costs. And I don't think, I mean, I've actually got a paper which I'm in the process of trying to write. It's one of these ones that have had a difficult birthing process. It's been, I think, about 6 years since I did a poster on it at a conference. Still not managed to get the paper out. Looking at direct nuclear heating for carbon dioxide removal. So you're not generating electricity, you're using nuclear to heat the carbon dioxide removal apparatus directly, and therefore you're not losing money through that electricity conversion process. Now, if you had super cheap nuclear because you've managed to get fusion completely cracked, it's not impossible that we could have a situation whereby we could, you know, dramatically reduce the cost of carbon dioxide removal. So, you know, that might go down. Let's say we get it down an order of magnitude again. So it's in today's money equivalent when we sort of build into economic growth. So we might look into a situation where we're spending, you know, that 0.4% of GDP. We might end up in a situation where we're removing a whole year's emissions of, you know, in 2020 emissions levels for what would be something like 0.4% of GDP in 2050 economic numbers, right? That starts to then look quite sensible, because you might want to remove a huge amount of legacy emissions if it genuinely was that cheap. You see what I mean? I don't think it's settled, but I think within the bounds of the numbers that we've got at the moment, I think it's hard to imagine, you know, could we imagine a society getting together and spending 5% of GDP for 100 years doing carbon removal? I think we both accept that's probably stretching the bounds of credibility. And I think you're probably quite right to say that it might be solar geoengineering or adaptation that we prefer. But then again, if you think about it, what's the cost of that? Let's assume that solar geoengineering either doesn't work or never reaches public acceptability. You're talking about adaptation. I mean, are we really going to be able to adapt to 100 years of sea level rise? I mean, I think that's highly questionable. You know, I think about half the world's population lives in what's sort of classified as a coastal region. So their house might not be underwater, but, you know, their local shopping center might be underwater, for example, right? So sea level rise would be a major impact on these people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's not impossible that if it was a straight choice between enduring that level of sea level rise and paying for carbon removal at 5% a year, I think people might well consider doing that. So I think it's that impossible.
Could be. Yeah, it's a little bit charitable comments, but it could be that you don't see the benefit directly yourself. But if you have the choice between doing carbon removal or doing adaptation for your city, you know, like the carbon removal is something that everyone has to pitch into for you to benefit. So it's that classical. We don't need, I know you're very familiar with that kind of thinking, so we don't need to go into it, but I think it plays in a role there as well.
But it's not impossible that we might, you know, at the moment we have a world which is sort of less cooperative than we might like and is rather beset by war, particularly at this momentary juncture in history. But, you know, looking back 20 years ago, we could have had a history which didn't end up with authoritarianism. We've, you know, there was a real possibility that Russia might have joined NATO 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that would have been if Putin hadn't gone mad and invaded Ukraine and tried to take over the world, then, you know, maybe we'd have had a more cooperative international order. So I don't think it's that impossible that we might have something akin to a world government in decades to come that might be able to enact carbon removal if people agree that it's actually cheaper than everybody adapting separately. I don't think these things are completely bonkers. So yeah. I think that's been a useful conversation to sort of scope how carbon removal might grow in future.
Mm.
We haven't spoken much about your annual report. I know that you didn't want to rehash your greatest hits on this podcast. So is there anything that you do want to highlight from your annual report that you might want to bring up now before we...
I think connected to this, what we see is some good growth still from small numbers, but it's kind of growing. Purchases are growing 500% or so year on year. So, I mean, you shouldn't make too much of that because it's very few actors, and Microsoft bought 60% of all tons ever sold.
Yeah.
So, but at least you wouldn't be able to say that we're not on track. So we need to keep the amount of big buyers up. There needs to be a constant inflow of new buyers to have a credible growth rate. And I think we need to have tens of millions of carbon removed by 2030 permanently. If we don't, then we're going to have to see some extreme growth rates in later decades to be able to reach sort of 4 gigatons, 5 gigatons in 2050. But currently we're on track for that. But of course, that could end at any time if there's not an inflow of new big buyers.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that when you've got a very small market, the economic forces that are moving that market forward might be very different from what would be the case when you have a much larger market. So you can't just sort of scale from one to the other. It isn't practical to sort of say. Pardon?
No, you can't extrapolate like that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, you can extrapolate, but I think the degree to which that extrapolation is likely to result in a fit is going to drop dramatically when you move. And a lot of the market at the moment is driven by, you know, reputation management, stuff like that, which are kind of not conventional economic forces. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, those fundamental forces in the market are going to change, or at least potentially going to change when the market scales. So we can't just assume that the growth rates and stuff that we've got right now are going to be the same as time goes on, right? The growth curve might shift dramatically as a result of the changes in the forces driving the market. It's not just like with solar power, there's always niche applications where people really needed it. But carbon removal isn't being driven by need. It's being driven by politics, fundamentally. Nobody actually needs to buy carbon removal at the moment.
Yeah.
They're doing so because there's an economic case around, you know, making a political statement by so doing it. And the growth curves resulting are not necessarily extrapolable, if that's even a word. So I don't think we should depend on them. But just returning to your report, is there anything in that report that you discussed that you felt you would like to highlight, you know, particular controversies? Obviously, people can go read the highlights and summaries if they want to. You don't necessarily want to cover that. But having done all the publicity and everything like that, you know, what have you learned from doing that report that we might want to know about what can we learn about the state of the market at the moment in carbon removal from the report that you've done?
And we covered a bit on the if we're trending on track, so that's something we discussed. Otherwise, you know, we see growth on all sectors, but we also did a survey connected to to this work for suppliers and purchasers, and there we could see that although purchasers are willing to pay a high cost, those that are engaged there early on and doing this Kickstarter market, we still see that over half of the companies that answer the surveys and suppliers have not sold anything. And in the Milky Way Climate Transformation Fund call for proposals, 75% of the durable CDR companies have never sold any tons. So that's something to highlight.
Oh, that really surprises me. Help me understand that. Because how I understand this market to be operating at the moment, there's enormous delays. So people are pre-selling their carbon credits for like 5 years hence.
Yeah.
But then you're saying that at the same time, you've got people who can't sell anything. So how can those coexist?
Well, some people get to sell and they pre-sell.
But why do... I mean,
there's not enough demand. So, I mean,
but if you've got people in the market, well, hold on, right? If you've got people in the market that are considering buying from someone like Climeworks, and then you've got, you know, another supplier who can come along and sell to them and deliver straight away because they don't have like a 5 year wait for Climeworks, why are people waiting 5 years for Climeworks when they could buy from another next year? Well, how does that make any sense?
Well, I mean, you're not buying carbon removal like today. You're paying into a Kickstarter.com campaign kind of thing to help support the ecosystem. You buy from the company you believe most in. You strategically put your money into the things that you think will accelerate this the most. You're not buying it to get one ton of carbon removal, at least not most early buyers, I would say. So it's not really about getting that ton as cheaply as possible. But to be fair, many of those that haven't sold, they also can only deliver in the future. They're going to build their facility, et cetera, but they have a company, they have people, and they have maybe started to do something. So it's not that some actually have unsold inventory as well of tons they already removed on the Bioshore side, et cetera.
So you've got Biochar that's been unsold, right? I mean, Biochar is a bit of a sort of slightly strange one because it's not quite the same as normal carbon removal. It's like a halfway house between
I don't think there's storage. I don't think there's a lot of DAC that's unsold because it's basically only Climeworks and then a very small pilot projects that were kind of pre-purchased. But what we're seeing is that most companies that have formed people that formed a CDR company have not yet made any deals.
And is that because these companies are just very young, or is it because there's a genuine problem selling in the market?
There's very few buyers still,
Frontier willing to buy.
Yeah, they're buying from a lot of companies, but we have hundreds of CDR companies now. It's more than 100 DAC companies alone. So I mean, they can't buy from all of them. And
yeah, I completely lose track of all of these different companies now. I used to be able to pretty much keep track of the carbon dioxide removal market, and I totally can't do that anymore.
So. We got 220 individual companies applying to our call for proposals for Milky Way.
Is your priority to try and buy from as many as possible, or is your priority to?
No, we don't have that much money that we could buy from, you know, so then it would be spread very thinly. No, it's trying to deploy this money as strategically as possible to accelerate the solutions that we believe most in terms of scalability and co-benefits and all that.
Okay, guide me through this. So what makes a solution backable? I mean, is there not an argument to say, well, we'll just buy 1,000 tons from absolutely everybody in the market and then we'll just sort of see who survives? Is that not a logical strategy?
No, because 1,000 tons, well, for some, 1,000 tons would be quite a lot of money. And you know, that if you buy that company that sells for $500 to $1,000 for their early tons, then you would have to spend, you know, maybe $500,000 or $1 million to buy 1,000 tons. And that could finance maybe their entire pilot facility. But I mean, if you have billions of dollars, sure, you could buy 1,000 tons from everyone. But we have a few million dollars, so we would have to be quite.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too stuck on the numbers. What I'm saying is, overall, is there not an argument that the best thing to do is to just not be that kind of selective about it and just buy from everybody and then just see what the market does? Is that not a sensible strategy?
Okay, I anchored on the 1,000 tons. Well, if you say instead $1,000 for everyone, I think that's a very bad strategy because, like, let's say one DAC company, to take an example, if we pay them $10,000 or something, they can't do anything with that. They can't use it to build their first of a kind facility, the demonstration facility. So the idea, the money is just wasted because they're not going to make any progress with that money. You need to give a meaningful amount enough for them to be able to move ahead and actually make some progress.
So basically, it's a matter of constrained resources. You're trying to deal with the fact that you've got constrained resources, and it's not necessarily that from a strategic point of view, it wouldn't be nice to give everybody a little bit of money and see what they do with it. What you're saying is that in an environment where resources are constrained, we can't possibly have an environment where every single company gets enough money to progress. Exactly.
If you give all your cows one apple per day, you know, all your cows die.
So it's not about sort of like, you know, giving a Bentley to your favorite child and then giving nothing to your others. It's more like, you know, you can't even afford to give a bicycle to all of your children. So you have to decide which one you give a bicycle to, right?
Sort of, yeah. And I would expect to see consolidation in the coming years as well, which the thing I really hope for is that it happens in a way so that all good ideas out there are given a chance and a shot at being tested. So
that's interesting. That's a really interesting point. So let's kind of think about how markets have evolved and whether they do or don't have the best ideas. I mean, I think one of the things that you can think of is like gasoline engines, for example. Probably the four-stroke cycle isn't the optimal gasoline engine. And there's been all kinds of different designs that people have tried to develop, but there's been an awful lot of inertia in the market.
Yeah.
That makes that, you know, the winning technology hasn't necessarily arisen. Now, there are some things that sort of don't work as well in cars, like gas turbines. They're not very good at turning power up and down, right? So there are reasons why gas turbines are great for jet engines, but they're pretty hopeless for vehicles. But if you just sort of stick to conventional internal combustion engines, not turbines, there are lots of different designs that have come and gone over the years, and none of them have really sort of broken through and beaten the four-stroke cylinder auto cycle. There's things like Wankel engines and stuff.
That's a great point.
Mazda generated. So what evidence have we got that the carbon removal market will actually do anything that's useful compared to this sort of stubbornly laggard automotive market that really hasn't,
we're not there. There's no winning technology right now. So, I mean, Frontier, I think, has a similar mindset. They're supporting a lot of different things. I think the U.S. government probably has to in some extent, but although the 45Q is limited to just a few approaches. So, although there are many DAC approaches, so they could still be, it's considered to be a many methods considered. So the funders of this space need to consider this, right? And not start backing a winner too fast. You need to make sure that all good ideas get proper testing if they have potential.
Okay, but you know, it's easy to say, but you know, what evidence have you got that the current way the market operates is going to lead to that or anything like that? I mean, are we not just going to end up getting stuck on a couple of different technologies which might be, you know, entirely suboptimal and might only be successful because of...
I'm not saying it will happen. I'm saying it's
incumbent effect.
I'm not making a prediction and saying this will surely happen. I'm saying that as a funder, that's what we're trying to do. And we encourage other funders to think in the same way.
Okay. Well, look, that's all very noble. But what I'm trying to draw you on is, do you think in reality, the market for CDR will work in a way such as to make the better technologies rise up? Or do you think that in all likelihood, we're going to end up with lock-in around suboptimal technologies? What do you think is the most likely outcome in this industry?
Well, I think that there's a big risk of that, of course, like that the most well-capitalized company's technology survives rather than the best technology. So that is, of course, a risk. And it's really hard to give a percentage or anything like that. I think there's a strong possibility for both cases. I think if you do test something out, and you do it at a TRL 6 or maybe even 7, and you have the data and you can show that this is indeed much better and much cheaper, then that might get acquired by this more well capitalized company, and they use that technology instead because they don't have a production line where they do millions of four-stroke engines, and they wouldn't lose a lot on changing. It's still so early that they could also pivot and just do whatever.
That's not where the lock-in comes from, because people build new car factories all the time, or certainly have been building new car factories for decades. The lock-in comes from, you know, a perceived technology risk where you know, funders are not willing to fund technologies that are seen as being more.
But it's so little built. All DAC and all call removal is very early. So
I understand that. But you
can say that in 2030 it might be harder, right? For new technologies that are invented in 2030, it might be harder. That's why we're also laser focused on broadening the starting field now, right? And not sort of anchoring. I don't think we should start scaling up and putting all the money into scaling up a few technologies. We should still put a lot of money into new stuff. So we use these early years to really broaden the starting field.
Yeah, I get it. But this isn't like a personal attack on you and your methodologies. What I'm saying is, do you think looking at the market as a whole, we'll end up locking into suboptimal technologies? Or do you think it's more likely that the market is going to be kind of smart in terms of, you know, giving a future which isn't based around, you know, locking into stuff which we shouldn't have locked into?
I would ask Greg Nemeth or someone that studied kind of more industrial policy. And like, to me, it's more like, yeah, I see both possibilities. What I'm going to say, 50-50.
Well, you can give us an intro to Greg Nemeth and get someone to talk on the show about that. That would make a fantastic episode. I'd be really interested to have a chat with Greg and see what he's got to say for himself. Right, fine. So we've been waffling on for quite some time now.
Yeah, we have to wrap this up.
Does this reach a natural end point, or is there anything else you want to add, or what?
I think so. Yeah, we covered a lot of ground now. For sure.
Okay,
that's a very cliche thing to say in a podcast, but yeah.
Well, let's briefly summarize where we've got to. So we've covered the following things. So there's at least a risk of technological lock-in around suboptimal technologies that, you know, people need to actively manage, so we don't end up with, you know, a B-grade technology when we could end up with an A-grade technology. It's kind of impractical to remove CO2 to cover up your methane emissions because you'd have to do so much of it. You could remove about 10% of current. Once we get to 2050 prices and the price of the market has fallen, we could remove about 10% of annual emissions for about 0.4% of current GDP, which is very affordable. And we can potentially increase that amount of money and spend around 5% of GDP and remove functionally all of our current annual emissions. But that would be, you know, a bigger shift to be able to do that, but not necessarily completely impossible. And what else have we covered? We talked about your institutions and how they are, how you're funded and how you're, you know, you're doing this not-for-profit company. What else have we looked at?
Well, if CDR is a finite resource and sort of how to treat CDR today connected to...
Do we have a scarcity or a growth mentality when it comes to when it comes to CDR? Okay, was that it? Is that all of the wisdom and learnings on the podcast, or is there stuff we've missed?
I can't. My brain is empty right now, so I have to. We have to re-listen and
pause to recharge Robert before we can get any more sense out of him. Well, I think that the closure of the podcast has therefore been completely forced. We've run out of Robert. And I'm pleased to get to that point where a guest has literally nothing more intelligent to say. We've broken them. Right. Consider yourself discharged. You've not got to the point of being able to reject or accept any work. Firstly, because you never publish anything. So I've pointed out before, but also because you've run out of batteries and stopped before the end of the podcast. Right. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for coming on, Robert. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.